We're about to close.
That won't be long.
You looking for anything in particular?
Something rare.
Let me guess. Classical.
Jazz.
Sax?
Coltrane.
Piano?
Monk.
Shadow Wilson on bass.
Shadow Wilson played drums.
Know why they call him Shadow?
Because he had a light touch.
You're in luck. I have a first pressing.
It really is you.
I've heard stories. They can't all be true.
Mr. Hunt, the weapons you recovered in Belarus were confirmed to be VX nerve gas, capable of devastating a major city. The bodies of the air crew were found less than 24 hours after they landed in Damascus. They were identified as low-level Chechen separatists, with neither the access nor the ability to acquire the weapons they were transporting. This would support your suspicion that a shadow organization is committed to inciting revolution by enabling acts of terror in nations friendly to Western interests. IMF suspects this to be the same shadow organization you have been tracking for the last year, also known as the Syndicate. IMF would be right. Normally, you and your team would be tasked with infiltrating and disrupting this terrorist network, but we have taken steps to ensure that this will not happen. Because we are the Syndicate, Mr. Hunt, and now we know who you are. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to face your fate. Pursue us, you will be caught. Resist us, you will be killed. And your precious secretary will disavow any knowledge of your actions. Good luck, Mr. Hunt. This message will self-destruct in 5 seconds.
I'm Joe Kramer, composer of Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to listen to this podcast from the GeekCast Radio Network.
Hello and welcome to GeekCast Radio. This will also be featured on Movie Week in Review. This is actually, it's kind of funny, folks. I am, of course, TFG and Mike from the GeekCast Radio Network. It's kind of funny. The GeekCast Radio Network, we're coming up on our 7-year anniversary this coming June in 2016, and MWire, Movie Week in Review, our general overall review movie podcast that Steve Megatron and I started when the network first launched, will actually have its 7th year anniversary on July 11th of next year in 2016. And in 7 years, we have never had an interview on Movie Week in Review until now, and I am very proud and very pleased to welcome the guy who makes movie scores self-destruct, Mr. Joe Kramer, the composer and conductor for Mission Impossible Rogue Nation.
Thank you, Mike. It's my pleasure to be here.
Yes, it's our pleasure to have you on the show, and I've been a fan of this franchise, obviously, for the last almost 20 years now. I've seen every film in theaters on opening day. MI5 is the first film in the franchise I've seen in theaters more than once.
That's great. I hope that means you liked it.
Yeah, well, yes, I liked the film, but the thing is, I mentioned this in my written review of the score. For some odd technical reason, whatever, I'm on La La Land Records promo list, so they send me copies of their stuff to review, whatever else, and didn't exactly get Mission 5 right when it came out, right when the movie came out, because the release of the soundtrack was a few days later or whatever else, yeah. So I didn't get my copy at the time. So I had to go back.
Right.
And I'm not saying this is a bad thing. By the time my copy of the score came in the mail, I was like, okay, I need to go see the movie again because it was still in theaters at the time. I need to remember what the hell happened so I can accurately write a good review of the score.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And I actually just finished watching the film again right before we started this.
Oh, cool.
I watched... I had planned on watching all five. That didn't happen.
That's ambitious.
I watched. Yeah, I know. It will happen eventually, but it didn't happen this time.
Listen, I'll be honest. When I got the job, I actually didn't watch any of the first four movies once I was hired. I'd seen them all when they came out, but I sort of vowed I would not go back and watch them until I'd finished the score because I didn't want to sort of even subconsciously, copy what the other guys had done.
Right. So. Mission Impossible, the film franchise is almost 20 years old. You are now in the Mission Hall of Fame alongside Danny Elfman, Hans Zimmer, and Michael Giacchino.
Yeah, Giacchino.
Giacchino, sorry.
No, it's okay.
I never know how to pronounce that guy's name.
Yeah, it's a lot of consonants.
Yeah, it is. I wasn't sure what to expect out of the fifth mission. Honestly, after the second one, I wasn't sure what to expect if the franchise was ever going to have another movie or so. But
no comment.
I like the second movie. Honestly, until Rogue Nation, the second movie was my number one favorite of the entire franchise.
Oh, there you go. See?
So, like I said, I was going to watch all five films in preparation for this, but I didn't get a chance to do that. What I did do, though, is I watched the first one and then I watched Rogue Nation.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how much 20 years will do to a guy. Because, oh my God, Ethan looks old in Rogue Nation.
Well, he looks like such a little kid in the first one.
Yeah.
You know, I did Jack Reacher with Tom and I did Rogue Nation. So that's the Tom I've had an experience with. That's the one I know. So when I see Mission 1 now, I think, how is that little kid running the IMF? You know what I mean?
Exactly. All right, so let's get the preliminaries out of the way. Where did you grow up and how did you end up? As a kid, did you always want to be a composer? Did you always want to be doing film soundtracks, TV soundtracks? How did that all come about?
Well, I grew up in upstate New York, outside the capital city of Albany, in a tiny town called Voorheesville. Which the longer the name, the smaller the town. And because the town was so small, I went to a very small high school. And as a seventh grader, I became friends with a senior named Scott Storm. And Scott was a filmmaker. He made films on Super 8. I'm just old enough that I got into filmmaking before the home video boom, where, everybody had camcorders and VCR, video editing equipment. This was all done on Super 8. And he cast me in a film he was making, and it was while we were working on that I told him, my father was an amateur musician, and we had a recording studio in our house with a four-track and some synthesizers. And I said, I have this equipment, I could probably make music for the movie. Would you be interested in that? And he said, yes. And so I was 15, and I was acting in and scoring a film, And, yeah, it wasn't a big Hollywood feature, but it was the same sort of process. When you boil it all down, it's the same thing I did on Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. The next year, he made another film in which I acted and did the music. And my co-star was one of his roommates at college named Brian Singer. And it was during that film that I met Brian's writing partner, Chris McQuarrie. And we became friends. And when I finally moved to L.A. 4 or 5 years after that, Chris and I lived around the corner from each other and we just hung out all the time. And we realized we had the same taste in movies and the same taste in music. And we sort of made a vow to work together if we had the chance. And I was very lucky because in 1999, when Chris made his directorial debut with The Way of the Gun, he invited me to do the score for that. And it proved to be a rewarding relationship, and we rekindled it when he made his second film as a director, Jack Reacher, in 2012. Mm-hmm. And then I was really grateful to be asked back to do music for Mission Rogue Nation last year.
Absolutely.
So that's sort of the story in a nutshell.
Yeah. I'm one of those types of people that when I go to move... Now, back, 15, 20 years ago, it was more... For me, the movie was more so depending on what actual licensed music was in it. Like, you take... take any film that features a Nickelback song.
Right.
Whatever. It doesn't matter what it
sure,
is.
Sure, well, like a Cameron Crowe thing where it's like
right,
you know,
yeah,
a song,
I mean,
song
it, well,
or
right, yeah,
thing
I mean, it,
with Peter Gabriel.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I'll give you a perfect example. In between 2001 and 2003... Again, I know everyone hates Nickelback. Fine, whatever. I don't. Whatever. But it's one of those things where 2001 they released Silver Side Up. 2003 they released The Long Road. In between that time, Daredevil came out, and they had a song on the soundtrack called "Learn the Hard Way." It was the only place you could find that song is on that soundtrack. So that for me, when I heard it in the movie, I'm like, oh my god, I remember that. It was actually my cousin Rachel's wedding, right before, like 2 days before the wedding. We went out, saw the movie, and as soon as I got out of the movie, right before Record Town and the mall closed that night, I went and got the Daredevil soundtrack because I wanted to hear that song. So that for me is what it used to be for movies and stuff like that. If I heard an actual song in a movie now, it's as soon as I hear the scored music, it's like I need to hear the way I write my reviews. I mainly write reviews for La La Land Records because they're the ones that send me stuff. Mm-hmm. So I have to actually sit there and watch the movie and hear the music along with where it's supposed to be intended.
Right.
And then I can come home, I can put my headphones on, and I can turn my iTunes up to 75 and just blare out and just sit here and just close my eyes and just listen to hearing every note that's put into something. And the way, no disrespect to any of the other composers, they've all done an amazing job on this franchise, but the way that you were able to mix in the original theme into your own work is just amazing. I'm trying to think of which track it is. I think it's either Havana to Vienna or The Morocco Pursuit, where it starts, you think it's starting with the main Mission Impossible theme, the theme we've known for the last 20 years in these movies.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns into something completely different. You only use like a half or 2 second beat of it.
Right. It was very important to me that the score feel cohesive. There have been a number of films where they've gone back and revisited franchises and they've had composers who didn't do the original films score the reboots or the remakes or the further episodes or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's been a case where they've used the original theme in the movie, but what they've done is they've sort of just used an arrangement or a recording of the original theme that doesn't sound anything like the rest of the score. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. That's a totally valid approach, but I didn't want to do that. I wanted it to sound cohesive, and I wanted it to sound like it was all the same voice. And so I took the liberty of pretending I'd written the theme to Mission Impossible, and I gave myself permission to do whatever I wanted with it. Mm-hmm. So, for example, one of the moments I think you're talking about is where we transition from the riverboat safe house to the sand dunes of Morocco. What I do to get you into that is I give you the introduction to the Mission Impossible theme with the trilling flute and the triangle, but instead of going into the Mission Impossible theme, I go into another theme Lalo wrote called The Plot, which is in this film kind of Benji's theme. Mm-hmm. And the idea being, I wanted to sort of fool the audience anytime I could. I wanted to make them think, oh, I'm taking them here, and then take them somewhere else. And so there, I figured the audience, if they're paying attention, they'll think we're going to go into the main title of Mission Impossible, and instead we go into something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's just amazing what you've done with this.
Well, thank you, man. That's very kind of you.
I mean, I've been listening to this since we actually confirmed when we're actually going to do this interview. I'm like, okay, I need to go back. I need to watch the movie again. I need to sit here and listen to the score all the way through multiple times. And seriously.
Yeah, it's very gratifying.
I have, because every time I get a new score from La La Land, whatever it is, if it's, you know, as long as it's something I'm interested in and something I want to have in my iTunes library, and not saying that most of their stuff isn't in my iTunes library, most of it is,
right.
But once I put it in there, it's like, okay, I need a playlist of just this album so I can go to this and listen to it from, you know, cover to cover. And like I said, you know, this morning before we get around to doing the interview tonight, I sat here before I watched Mission 1. I sat here and hit, you know, the A400.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, turned it up, closed my eyes, and just sat here and listened to it. And, man, it is – people, I'm not just sitting here stroking his ego at all. I'm telling the truth. If you're a fan of this franchise, this is the most – like he said, cohesive. This is the most cohesive the score has ever been.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you.
It just is.
You know, I worked really hard. You know, I took the theme and I broke it down into sort of three or four pieces. The first piece being that trill. That's mm-hmm. the introduction. The second element being the bass line, which is the sort of famous bum, bum, ba-dum, bum, bum, ba-da-dum, dum. And then the other element or two being the tune, which is the da-na-na, da-na-na. And that tune is sort of divided into two halves, where it's four phrases that go down and then four phrases that go up. And right. I gave myself permission to mix and match those elements in any way that I fancied, whether it was taking it and slowing it down or speeding it up or using the first half and then taking it in another direction.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and sort of liberally sprinkling it throughout the score repeatedly rather than just using it once, say, for the main title and then right. never referencing it again.
Right.
And, you know, an interesting side note to this is that, you know, in my discussions with Chris and Tom, a notion came up that it would be interesting if this film was considered more of a sequel to the TV show than a mm-hmm. sequel to the first four movies.
Mm-hmm.
Combined with that was a direction from Tom to definitely embrace going retro and
yeah.
to embrace percussion. And those three thoughts, you know, keeping in line with the TV show, keeping in line with a retro sound and percussion, really created a good sort of set of rules for me to stick to as I wrote the score. And what I essentially tried to do was write a score that Lalo could have written and recorded in 1966 when the show began. So I didn't use any synthesizers and I didn't use any drum loops or techno sounds or synth beds. Mm-hmm. You know, it was all instruments that were at Lalo's disposal in 1966 when he did the film. Mm-hmm. And I think that also helped give it a retro sound, and it didn't let that limit my writing. So for the music for the Taurus sequence, for example, you know, mm-hmm. I sort of wanted to create the feel of techno music with the sort of pulsing bass and relentless you know, the ostinato and stuff like that, arpeggios mm-hmm. and stuff. But I did it using acoustic instruments rather than synthesizers. And hopefully it was effective.
It's very effective. I mean, every, you know, watching the film again today, since it's out on home media finally.
Yeah, well, it's out. It's right now. It's out on iTunes and Amazon and Vudu as digital. It's out on disc in the UK today, I know, and it hits the UK or it hits disc in America on the 15th.
On the 15th. Well, yeah.
Yeah.
So you know, watching this through through iTunes, because I get everything through iTunes most of the time. It's like it's just so much easier.
Less shelf space.
Yeah. Well, then you got to worry about computer space, but that's a whole other discussion. I know in the liner notes for the booklet, you had said that they had hired you to do the opera scene first, to do a sampling for that first. Did they want you to just do that, or did they want you to do the whole? Okay.
Yeah, I'll be more specific. What happened was they shot some elements for the opera scene in Vienna, mm-hmm. and they hadn't hired a composer yet because you typically don't, the composer doesn't start working on a film until it goes into post-production. Mm-hmm. But they realized shooting in Vienna that it would really be helpful to have a musician on the production team while they're shooting the opera sequence. Chris McQuarrie had already chosen the opera he wanted to use, which was Puccini's Turandot. And mm-hmm. he knew which parts of the opera he wanted to use for the different sequences in the film. But they didn't have anybody on their staff who understood how to take that and how to work with that so that what they shot was usable, but they weren't locked into anything so that they could change things later if they needed to. So I was brought out to England to figure out the game plan for using Turandot as the opera and synchronizing all that so that they could film Tom's fight scene without painting themselves in a corner editorially. But the plan was always to use the Turandot music for that sequence and to use the parts that they used for that sequence. Mm-hmm. I was there really as a supervisor and consultant to make sure that that they did everything in a way that it would be usable when they finished the film. I was also simultaneously hired to actually write the score at that point, but it was understood that I wouldn't really be able to start composing the score properly until the film was virtually finished shooting and mm-hmm. had moved into the editing phase.
So once that happened, you were obviously able to see the mm-hmm. almost the final film pretty much. How did you go about writing
the score,
and crafting the score while watching what was on the screen?
Well, what you do is, I mean, at the most basic level, you look at a scene, and in Chris McQuarrie's case, he does not like to use temp music when he's editing the film. So more often than not, I look at a scene with no music at all. And I, you know, over years of work on films, you develop a sense of where music feels like it should come in. And a lot of it just based on your feeling and your instinct. Mm. So you look at the scene and you go, it feels like when she turns her head, that's when I'm starting to feel like music should be there. Up until that point, I'm okay with just dialogue and sound effects. But at this point, it feels like music should start coming in. So then it becomes a process of sort of breaking down. It's almost like a flow chart. Well, is the music going to be fast or slow? Is the music going to be happy or sad, major, minor, bright or dark, you know? Then it's like, okay, it's going to be slow music that's going to be dark. Well, does that mean then strings or brass or woodwinds? Well, it's going to be very string heavy with a little bit of brass, a little bit of woodwinds. And, you know, where's it going to come out? So now I know, okay, I've got to write 90 seconds of slow, dark string music. And, you know, by breaking it down like that, I sort of reach a point where I can start to go, okay, great. I know how to do slow, dark string music, and I write that. And then I look at that against the picture, and I show it to Chris, and then what begins is a back-and-forth process of discussion about, look, we like it here. This part, I would like you to lighten the mood a little bit. It's a little heavy. Or I might say to Chris, you know, I feel like I could actually be a little heavier here or a little darker or a little lighter myself. So, you know, We revise the cue. At that point, it's converted into sheet music, put in front of musicians, and even during the recording, Chris and I will both have notes and discussion about maybe the players are playing it a little too emotionally. We'd like them to back off and be a little colder, you know, and it's a process that's always open to revision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So with all that said and done, how did you go about, you know, you said you gave yourself permission to use the original theme, how you wanted to use it, and use it, you know, you almost use it sparingly a little bit. You use it a lot, but you use your own.
I use elements of it a lot, and I hint right. at it a lot, but I actually don't full out. I only full out really present it, I think, three times in the movie. Once when Ethan mm-hmm. jumps on the wing of the plane, the main right. title, and then the end title. Mm-hmm. I sort of hint at it when he escapes from Blenheim, but mm-hmm. even then it's hinted at. It's not fully presented.
Well, I mean, you know, themes like the Mission Impossible theme, themes like Harold Faltermeyer's Axel F, themes like that, you know, Bond, you know, you don't necessarily need the whole, you need that character beat. When,
right.
Like you were saying with the plane, you know, Benji and Brandt are going back and forth, and then Luther comes in, and then all of a sudden you have, you know, hair over his one eye, Tom Cruise coming up on the scene saying, you know, can you open the door?
Right.
And as soon as he comes on this, you know, it's like, you know, 1989 Batman. As soon as Batman comes on the screen, that's when the Danny Elfman
right.
main title pops in, because it's for the character. It's not necessarily, you know, like you said, you know, if you want the full theme, listen to the beginning of the movie or the end of the movie. That's where the full theme
right.
will play. But, you know, you said you use little beats of it here and there. How did you go about choosing, when you were watching the movie, where to put in the beats for?
Sometimes it was instinct. It just felt like it needed it. Sometimes it was a conscious decision of, like, you know, this is a moment. For example, there's a moment where Tom is shimmying up a pole. He's like chained to a pole. He's handcuffed to a pole. And he
in the prison scene, up yeah.
And it just felt like it needed some reference, because it's kind of a superhuman thing that he's doing. It's a pretty extraordinary stunt. And it just felt like it needed a reference to the sort of history of Mission Impossible at that yeah. moment. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Similarly, say, there's a bit where, and it's a more subtle moment, where Ilsa is explaining who Solomon Lane is. And she explains that there was this USB memory stick, and it's hidden in this vault, but you can't break in because it's impossible. And she uses the word impossible. And we cut mm-hmm. to Tom, and he smirks. And it just felt like it needed a reference to Mission Impossible there, you know?
Absolutely. Well, anytime you use that word, I mean, yeah. that's, you know.
And then a third moment that's nice is when after Tom has been shocked back to life, and they run mm-hmm. out to get in the car and pursue Ilsa, and he goes to do this jump over the car, and he completely chokes and falls and lands on his head. So we sort of hinted, we start the Mission Impossible theme like it's going to be a hero moment, and then we cut it off early because he chokes.
I love that scene.
So there you go. You
know? I just love that scene. What was it like scoring the motorcycle chase? How did you come up with that part of the score?
That was actually, it was very funny. That was a piece that was written the day before we recorded it. I had written a whole other piece for that sequence, and in fact, a couple different versions. And Chris had signed off on them. And then we did a piece of music elsewhere in the film that was very fast. And Chris was so excited by it that he said, I would love it if you could rewrite the motorcycle chase so it's fast, like this other scene. And mm-hmm. so I rewrote it. And the main sort of impetus of the rewrite was speed, to mm-hmm. really sell speed. And there was quite a learning curve on this film for Chris and I, because Chris had never made a film with action music before. Wave the Gun and Jack Reacher both left their action sequences mostly unscored. And in this film, we both knew that this film was going to need action music. And it was a process of discovery for Chris and I as to what type of action music fit his style of filmmaking. You know, I'd done plenty of films with action music before, but never one with Chris. And so there was a process of discovery for that. And the motorcycle chase was probably epitome of that, the high point of that. And essentially what I did was I looked at the film. I had sort of one note was speed. Another thought was that the sound design of the motorcycles was going to be like this screaming loud engine. There's going to be wind rushing past the characters' ears. There were going to be engines of the cars they were passing. There was all this sound design, and that was going to eat up a large part of the spectrum of sound. And so what I was left with was sort of very low sounds and very high sounds. Those were the sounds that were going to be audible above the sound design of the engines. And that meant flutes and piccolos and trumpets and horns in the top of their register, and then trombones and basses and cellos down and piano down on the bottom, giving, and timpani and bass drum, giving drive and power. And that's essentially, again, it's like that flow chart I was talking about. You just, you set up, you ask yourself basic questions, you answer them, and then you write music that follows the answers you gave.
Absolutely. I think while watching the movie, the outside of obviously the main title and the end title and all that, and that opening sequence, I think my favorite part is the reveal of the team and how you worked around that, like at the end,
meet the IMF.
Where they put them in the glass box.
Yeah. And it's a very rewarding thing when, you know, Chris as a director, he's not afraid to let music get big and for music to take center stage. And that's a rare thing. A lot of directors get very nervous about music. And, you know, there's a very big trend in today's filmmaking to have music be a drone or a very subconscious, very quiet sort of background pad. And Chris is not afraid to push it front and center. And what's really nice is that, you know, I constructed a theme for Ethan Hunt that was built around the same sort of chord sounds that that Lalo's Mission Impossible theme was built around. But I tried to sort of hide that from the audience until that last moment so that I could put them together and you go, you know, wow, they fit together. I never thought of that. I never saw that coming. And, you know, hopefully it sounds like that worked. And I'm very grateful when anybody tells me that, you know, they liked it, because that was my goal.
Yeah. I mean, no, that, like, because the whole movie, right from the start, when, you know, you have him going into the store and he goes in. And again, you know, going back to what you said earlier, that they told you to make it retro. The whole movie feels retro. You know, like you already said, it feels like something that came right after the TV series.
An interesting side note to that is the very first scene in the very first episode of Mission Impossible has our star going into a record store and asking for a record and putting it on a record player and getting his mission from the record player. Yeah. So that scene was a conscious nod back to the origin of the TV show.
Absolutely. In that scene, you know, right from there, you know, once the audience meets Lane as a villain and he shoots the record store clerk, I'm like, I have no idea how this movie is going to end. I have no idea how they're going to catch him. And yet, when I realized the moment that he drops down through the ceiling, and I realized what was going to happen, because Hunt was on the floor, and he was standing there, and the next thing you see the glass walls moving into place.
Yeah, spoiler alert, by the way.
Well, the movie's been out.
I know, I'm just kidding.
You know, I mean, come on now. It's not like we did this right as it hit theaters. Yeah. But it's one of those things where I wasn't sure how the movie would, like, how the villain was going to be caught. And the whole, you know, irony of, you know, putting him in his own trap, and the way that the way that this movie played out, both in the action and the music, even some of the softer times. I mean, you've got some pretty low and slow themes in this.
Well, that's the other thing, is Chris isn't afraid to let the music be emotional. And so the scene where Ilsa says, let's run away. Let's just leave all this behind and run away together. It's a very sort of touching, sentimental, emotional scene. And he let the music he let the music support that rather than fight it or suppress it. And, you know, people have reacted. And it was also nice because, you know, I had this idea that in addition to incorporating Lalo's music in the score as organically as possible, I wanted to find a way to include the opera music in the score. And that became a perfect moment to include the part of the score that Ethan hears, the part of the opera Ethan hears when he first sees her at the opera house, which happens to be the sort of famous Nessun Dorma theme. And, you know, so I was able to use it when she invites him to run away with her, and then to use it at the end when she says goodbye.
Yeah. Well, you know, you essentially are using that as almost their...
It's like their love theme.
Yeah.
Or their unlove theme.
Yeah, the unlove theme. It's like, you know, and it felt like... I don't know. Between Ghost Protocol and Rogue Nation, even though it's only a 4-year difference, it felt like longer than I had seen a Mission film. It really, because the way that you know, Ghost Protocol ends, the way that Rogue Nation begins and how Rogue Nation is, it just, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the whole me being nostalgia because next year is the 20th anniversary of the first film or whatever, but it felt like forever since I had seen these, since I had seen Luther, Benji, and Ethan.
Interesting.
And I'm kind of glad that they've stuck with that team. I mean, they bring in one or two other members here and there throughout the movies, but right. I'm really glad since Benji came on in the fourth film that they've kept him kind of going, and he didn't.
Yeah, it's a nice blend of personalities. Tom and Simon have a great sort of camaraderie together, which is fun to see. I think Luther and Brandt have a funny chemistry that works really well. So I don't know who's coming back for the next one, but certainly they could do worse than to bring everybody, all the guys back from five.
Yeah, absolutely. At this point, I'm not sure what else they could do. Like, I mean, don't get me wrong. I want an MI6. Don't get me wrong. But you look at the five films and, you know, Mission 1 is all about, you know, Mole Hunt and whatever else. Mission 2 is, you know...
John Woo.
You know, jousting on motorcycles. Mission 3 is JJ and exploding chips and heads. And
yeah.
Mission 4, sort of, they destroy...
internal affairs, you know.
Yeah. And Mission 4 is almost continuing that kind of internal affairs thing.
Right.
And by the time we get to Rogue Nation, it's like... Oh, hey.
Well, I have no insider info. I can only tell you my own thoughts, my own suspicions, if you will. But this is the first film that will be directed by a director who's already, you know, every film has had a new director. This is the first time we're bringing a director back for Mission 6. So I have a suspicion that Mission 6 will feel very much like a continuation of Mission 5. But that, again, I have no inside info.
Yeah.
That's just my guess. You know, I think everybody really loved Rebecca Ferguson. I wouldn't be surprised if she came back. And that, you know, between that and like we were talking about with the operatives, with the IMF team, I think it'll feel like a companion piece to Mission 5. And probably the same way that Spectre feels like a companion to Skyfall, for example.
Yeah. All right, so before I let you go, I usually do this, and it usually should be stated that you would have a way to listen to whatever that I'm going to ask you on this question, but
okay.
I gotta ask you the Desert Island question. If you could only have one score from one other composer, not something you worked on, what would it be, and why would you have it on there and be listening to it forever?
I think it would be the Star Wars score, the first score. Star Wars.
A New Hope.
A New Hope, as it's called now. But it'd be the special edition version with all the music on it in film order, not the original album. Which I love the original album, but, you know, I'm a purist.
Awesome. Yeah,
that'd be my Desert Island disc.
All right, what have you got? Is there anything that you've got coming up that you can kind of tease the folks with?
There's nothing yet. You know, I was in England for 5 months working on Rogue Nation, and I didn't get to see my family the whole time I was gone because of, you know, work and stuff. So I've just been enjoying being back home. You know, I've been doing lectures and classes and interviews about the work on Rogue Nation. And I'm looking forward to 2016 and seeing what opportunities Rogue Nation will bring me, you know, with other filmmakers and other producers.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right, folks, you can get Mission Impossible Rogue Nation from LaLaLandRecords.com. I will have a link in the show notes for this interview so you can go check it out. Seriously, people, go listen to this score. Go watch this movie.
So you know, too, the disc, the CD version from La La Land Records has two tracks that aren't on the download from iTunes or digital services. So if you want to get the most complete version, you want to order the physical disc from La La Land Records.
Absolutely. Now, that I got hung up on that for a bit at first with one of the other CDs they had sent me. That just means that they're not on the digital. It's stuff from – it's music that's in the movie, right? It just means that it's not on the digital download version, right?
Well, what it is because the CDs cost a little bit more to manufacture, and that means that it costs a little bit more for the customer to buy it. The CD companies like to try to include a piece of music from the film that's exclusive to the CD. The only way you can get it is on the CD. It's not on the digital version. But yeah, it's from the movie. It was written for the movie and recorded for the movie. In the case of one of the bonus tracks, it's actually an alternative version to the one heard in the movie. But it was intended for the film. It's not like I just wrote it arbitrarily and stuck it on the CD.
Right. So. All right.
Great.
Well, I'd like to thank Joe Kramer. We'll ask you to hold the line.
Yep.
And folks, go check out Mission Impossible Rogue Nation.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Face to face. Just as you wish, Stephen.
Gentlemen, this is Solomon Lane. Mr. Lane, meet the IMF.
Joe Kramer here, composer from Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. This podcast from the GeekCast Radio Network will self-destruct in 5 seconds.